Now, Memorial Park Golf Course has been hosting the event since 2020. The course underwent a 10-month renovation in 2019, overseen by Tom Doak with player consultant Brooks Koepka, who is expected to play this week. Memorial Park is also hosting the LPGA Chevron Championship in 2026.
We would need all day to list the notable designs that Tom Doak has created over the last 30 years. This is just some of the highlights. Tara Iti and Cape Kidnappers in New Zealand, obviously a couple of great courses, Pacific Dunes and Old MacDonald out at Bandon. He's worked every corner of the globe, well beyond Memorial Park in Houston. But Tom joins us now. Tom, it's always good to see you and catch up. When you got involved in Memorial Park with Brooks Koepka as a consultant on it, you obviously knew it was going to be a PGA Tour venue. Did that change how you approached the job, knowing that the best players in the world were going to be taking on your work?
Absolutely. It was a very different job for me, and that's why I was interested in it. I think, you know, my reputation was, oh, he does beautiful remote golf courses, and working on a tour course is outside of his wheelhouse. And so I had a chip on my shoulder. And, you know, this seemed like it's the hardest combination of things to do, to work on a course that is a municipal course and plays 60,000 rounds a year and can still host the professionals and test them.
Now, I read that when you sat down at first to do this project with Brooks, you kind of sent him a questionnaire. You wanted to get his thoughts on some design concepts. What stood out there? And did anything surprise you that he told you?
Well, the first thing that surprised me was he had a lot of ideas about design, because I hadn't really heard that from other sources. But he was very vocal about the things that he liked and didn't like. That one of the things he said was, if we just built it so all the par threes weren't 200 yards long, we'd be heroes. Because, you know, that's usually where architects look to get length when challenging the pro players. You know, even the longest par four we can build, they're hitting 7 irons too now. But you don't want a set of par threes for everyday play that every hole's 210 yards. And he pointed out that, you know, some of his favorite courses and the places he'd won, like Shinnecock has that great 11th hole, and Erin Hills has that great little 9th hole. You know, just they're very short. They're within anybody's capacity, but you just barely miss, and you can make a double bogey.
Tom, I remember a widen sodden dinner we had in New Zealand more than 20 years ago, and you had a great line over dinner that night where you said that some architects have a tendency to not actually look at how their work is played in the field, and they will continue making the same mistakes elsewhere. How much attention have you paid over the last few years to how Memorial?
I lost your sound there in the end, so hopefully you can hear me okay. But I certainly thought about it in terms of trying to make the golf course fun and playable for everybody else. And the first year or two of the tournament, I came back for the whole week to look and see if there were things that we hadn't anticipated and that we needed to make changes. We did add a couple of back tees after the first year. We've changed the 17th hole now. But it's kind of an awkward thing because you don't want to, you know, it takes me about 30 days on the road to go build a new golf course, and taking another 30 days to go back and watch the same golf course is kind of hard. You know, most of my own courses, I'm lucky if I get back to every 4 or 5 years, because I think when you and I talked in New Zealand 20 years ago, I'd done 15 golf courses on my own. Now I've done 50. So it's much harder to get back as often as I'd really like to get back.
Tom, I apologize for the audio issues. A lot of us have wanted to unplug Amy Lynch's mic over the years, so I'm happy whoever pulled that off, but I'll go ahead and try to bring us home on a couple more. I was reading that when you decided to redesign the golf course, and I understand there was a balancing act, trying to create a golf course for the world's best players, as well as for everyday play. For 51 weeks out of the year, there's a lot of common folk like me who play that golf course. And the one thing that you said that really fascinated me is this wasn't about distance. If you look at the difference between the common player, the amateur, and the pro, strokes gain distance is not that big of a disparity, as opposed to what happens when it comes to the bunkers. So your idea coming into this was fewer bunkers?
And that was one of Brooks's suggestions too. He said bunkers were just not really a hazard for him on a normal golf course. He said, yes, on a links course in Scotland, you're right up against the face and you have to take a wedge and go out sideways. I have to play around that. But a normal bunker in the United States, even if I'm in it, I can pick the ball really clean. You know, there's not going to be a big tall face that keeps me from hitting 7-iron on the green from 185 yards. So it's just not that much of a hazard for him. And if he's in a bunker around a green, he's trying to hole it, which, you know, obviously that's not what the average player at Memorial Park experiences. So I was really pleased. I saw Robbie Ware yesterday who does the setup for the tournament. And he said he had played Memorial Park about a month ago with a couple of friends, and they went out at noon and played in 4 hours and 15 minutes, because there's not that many things out there that take a lot of time. You can find your ball. If you hit it in a water hazard, you're just dropping right there. There's not a lot of bunkers you have to rake yourself a mile out of when you're done. And I was really pleased to hear, as busy as a golf course as that is, that they can keep the pace of play up.
Now, Eamon pointed this out at the beginning of the interview. Your list of golf courses that you have built over the years is Hall of Fame worthy. There's some amazing tracks in there. But the idea that you had to do that balancing act here between the Brooks Koepkas of the world and the Eamon Lynches of the world, how proud are you of that?
I'm proud because it seems like it's worked out so far. I mean, you know, obviously every course you build, you want to build it for as wide a range of players as possible. The only difference is, you know, so even when I built Cape Kidnappers, we wanted that to challenge really good players. But what we didn't worry about is what would be the winning score if you brought all the best players in the world here and played 72 holes. That's really, you know, for most of my jobs, as long as those players get out there and have fun and have at least a few shots during the round where they have to like focus and really hit a good shot in order to get rewarded, that's all I'm trying to do. I mean, if they shoot 63, that doesn't bother me because they're so long and they're so good. When they're on, they're on. You just want a golf course that brings that out of them instead of worrying about the winning score.
How many projects are you working on right now, Tom, around the world? And are there any tantalizing prospects that you can share with us?
Well, it's funny. It depends how you ask the question. We've only got one thing under construction right now, a new golf course in the panhandle of Florida for Michael Kaiser. I've got about 10 things that I've drawn plans for and signed up for that I, you know, probably only 6 or 8 of them will ever happen. That's part of the business that most people don't understand is you can't really count on any one project. You know, permits are hard. They're just getting more and more expensive to build. Probably the two golf courses that I'm most proud of that have opened recently, a place called Childress Hall in Texas, a private club on kind of sandhills kind of ground, but overlooking the Red River up in the northeastern or north central part of Texas, I guess. And I just finished a project called Punta Brava in Mexico. You may remember like 20 years ago, Tiger Woods was going to build a golf course in Mexico. That was going to be one of his first golf courses. And then 2008 happened and the whole thing fell through. A friend of mine looked at getting involved with it in 2015 and he couldn't get the deal done. But when they finally did get it done, they called me back because I talked to him about, you know, what I thought viewed doing differently. And that is just, it's the most spectacular piece of ground I've ever seen for a golf course, you know, where you're right on the Pacific coast. You can hit the ball into the Pacific Ocean on 7 or 8 holes. It's a spectacular place. It took forever. It's solid rock. It took 3 years to build. We had archaeologists in front of us the whole time. That'll be somewhere on my list of best golf courses.
That's a heck of a statement, Tom, given some of the pieces of property you've worked on over the last 30 years.
I know. People
look
at me sideways when I say it, like, you can't be serious. And I'm like, well, when you hit a ball off the cliff in Bandon, do you see it splash in the ocean? No, I mean, I've never built a golf course where you would have that at all. And this course has it just in spades all over the place.
Depends how wayward you are off the top of those cliffs in Bandon, Tom. It's always great to catch up with you. We look forward to doing it again in the future. Thanks for the time today.
Nice to see you, Eamon.
All right, Hal Sutton is a past champion of this week's tour event, the Texas Children's Houston Open. The 14-time tour winner joins next for a walk down memory lane.
We're moving along on golf today. 25 years ago, the Texas Children's Houston's Open was played at TPC at the Woodlands. Hal Sutton came out on top that week. 3-under par 69 in the final round beat Joe Durant and Lee Johnson by 3 strokes. That victory was the 14th and final win on the PGA Tour for Sutton.
Now take a look at his career notes. 14-time PGA Tour winner, as Amy just said, including the 1983 PGA Championship and a 2-time Players Champion in 1983 and 2000, as well as that 2001 victory at the Houston Open. And we welcome in Hal Sutton now. Hal, thank you so much for taking the time. I want to start with 2001 and that victory at the Houston Open. Give me an idea of where your head was at that point in your career. You had tried to win Houston a couple times. You had 2 runner-up finishes, and you were past 40 years old. What did that victory mean to you?
Well, at a later stage in life, you know, certainly 42 or whatever I was, winning then meant a lot. You know, it meant I could still do it. So it meant a great deal.
You had a terrific career, Hal. Those 14 wins on the PGA Tour, you won a major, you won a couple of players. You were competitive deep into your 40s. When you look back on it now, are you happy with what you accomplished, or is there still part of you thinks about some of the events that maybe got away from you over the years?
Well, I think everybody would always say you look back on it and you regret the ones that got away. You're appreciative and grateful for the ones that you were able to win. You know, we would always do something different if we could go back, but I'm happy with my career. It was a long, eventful career. You know, I had ups and downs just like everybody.
Going back to 2001 again at the Houston Open, you started that round 2 shots back and you closed with a 69. It was a very tough day. What do you remember about that final round and then the birdie on 17 to put you ahead?
It's windy, you know, that course, renders birdies, bogeys, doubles, eagles. You know, I was one of the ones, I was actually on the board when the tour decided to leave and go to Redstone. I was the only guy that voted against it because I love the finish on that golf course. It was exciting for the fans. It was exciting as a player. You know, if you could get through 17 and 18, you know, under par or even, you had beaten the crowd basically, and it just made for a great finish. So, you know, it was a tough day. I remember the winds moving all over the place, so hard to figure the wind.
Al, you mentioned your previous service on the board of the PGA Tour. You've had a long career out there, and we just saw last week Brian Rolapp announce a vision for what he'd like to see the Tour become over the next couple of years. What do you think of the direction that the Tour seems to be going in?
Well, that's really hard for me to say. You know, I've been removed from the tour for quite a while, and, you know, it looks to me like they're responding to a lot of things that maybe Liv did. You know, one of the things that I would like to see is the tour was at the core of the tour was always about charity. And I hear them talk about charity very little anymore. And I think that's why corporate America embraced the tour was because so many charities benefited from the tour coming to town. And, you know, the race to $3 billion in charities was always something you heard about. You don't ever hear about any of that anymore. So from an old guy, I'd like to see the tour embrace that more.
You've seen all the commissioners come and go in this organization over the years. If you had one piece of advice for Brian Rolapp going forward, what do you think it is? What should he, other than the charitable component of it, is there one, he's not really a golfer by his own admission. Is there one thing that you would ask Brian Rolapp to keep in the forefront of his mind?
No, I'm not going to second guess anything. You know, he's coming from a background of football, and it's a completely different sport, and many of the fans are completely different too. So, you know, I'm not going to be an armchair quarterback, so to speak, and tell him what to do. But, you know, I'm going to second one more time, charity should be at the forefront of it.
Now, one of the things that has got brought up over this process of maybe the PGA Tour culling the schedule a little bit, where you would have the top players play more in line with 20, 21, 22 events. Over the course of your career, it looked like you averaged 25, 30. Looking back, would you have rather had maybe a smaller schedule, or did you enjoy playing that many times?
Well, I felt like I had to play that much in order to keep any sort of continuity going. You know, you work into playing well, and if you're not playing well, you need to evaluate, and the only way you can evaluate is by playing. So, you know, I played a lot because I wanted to win as many as I could and stay as sharp as I could. So, you know, I think it's different for every player. I don't think there's an exact formula.
Augusta National has coming up in a couple of weeks. That golf course always kind of seemed to have your number, with all due respect. Your results there were not what they were in other major championships. Was there any particular reason why you felt you didn't perform over the years on that golf course?
Well, I tended to hit the driver lower and I tended to fade it, which would have been fine if I'd have been left-handed, but because I was right-handed, it didn't really work so well. And the other thing is, you know, if I'd have been longer, that would have helped too. So I ended up being aggressive with my iron play. And if you short-side yourself at Augusta, you're dead, basically. So I did that too much. And, you know, and then once it gets in your head that, you know, you just don't feel good on the golf course. You know, I didn't go in there with a positive attitude like I did, say, at TPC or one of the other places. You know, just in my mind, it just didn't fit me.
I'm glad you brought up TPC, and I apologize. This is probably a week too late, but at the Players' Championship, there was a lot of debate about, is it a major, is it not a major? Now, I know you kind of a vote on this, being a two-time champion, but what are your thoughts on it after all of these years, seeing it again after decades of experience on that golf course?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's the best field in golf, so, and it's certainly over one of the great venues in golf. It's got maybe one of the greatest finishes in golf. So I don't know if that qualifies it as a major. Somebody else besides Hal Sutton's going to have to decide that. But certainly as a player, I can tell you I'm proud of those two wins, because you got to beat a really good golf course and you got to beat the best field in golf.
Hal, as recently as last week, Keegan Bradley was talking about how he finds it so difficult to let go of the loss at the Ryder Cup last summer. Is that something you experienced after your loss as captain, that it does burn you for a while afterwards?
Well, yes. You know, I quit golf for 5 years after I was Ryder Cup captain. I completely left. And so, yeah, it burned you, you know. And, you know, I think I personally don't feel like the captain can affect things as much as maybe the world thinks they can. You know, I was both a player, four-time player, and a captain, and I can tell you that the first three times I played really, really well, and the captain didn't affect it. And the last time I played was in 2002 when they had delayed it for a year, and I wasn't playing very well. And I went to Curtis and said, look, I'm not playing that great, so don't feel bad if you don't want to play me. I want the team to win. It's not about Hal Sutton. It's about the team. And he played me once beforehand, and I played the singles. Scott Verplank and I won, and then I lost the singles. But I can tell you that nothing Curtis Strange could have done could have helped me play better that week. And, you know, I'd like to put it to rest. It's upon the players to win the Ryder Cup, not on the captain. And, you know, I feel bad for Keegan. I wish, you know, I put in a call to him and he never returned my call. I wanted to try to help him and make him feel better about it, because it's a struggle. You know, it's an honor to be asked to be the Ryder Cup captain. And then it's a burden to carry the load that everybody puts on you. So, you know, I don't know what else I can say.
Well, I did want to follow up on that. Walking away from the game for 5 years because of that experience, maybe as a captain, what finally got you over the hump? Why did you finally get to a mind space that you were okay with whatever happened at the Ryder Cup?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story real quickly. Jackie Burke called me on the phone. I was building Boot Ranch at the time, and he said, "Hal, I want to drive out there tomorrow, and I want you to meet me on the practice tee at 10 o'clock in the morning." And I said, "Jack hadn't any balls in forever." He said, "You're a golfer. Meet me on the practice tee." So I met him on the practice tee the next morning, and he said, "Hal, I just drove 4 hours to ask you if someone could buy your golf game, how much would you sell it for?" And I said, "Well, why would we even ponder that? Because it's not possible." And he said, "Now, come on, work with me." He said, "If Michael Dell found a doctor that could extract your golf game from your body, and he's very wealthy, what would you tell him you wanted for it?" And I said, "Well, it'd be a lot. I have no idea. It'd have a lot of zeros behind it." He said, "Okay, then, why would you treat something that means that much to you the way you've treated it for the last 5 years then?" He said, "I got to go back to Houston." So the point being is my golf game was my golf game, and my relationship was with the game itself, not with everything and all the outside world. So I started back to playing golf, and I don't regret it. I do regret quitting for 5 years, because it was really hard to resurrect a golf game after you quit for 5 years. So, but you know, it was very personal, leaving the Ryder Cup, losing like that. So, you know, there was a lot of controversy in my Ryder Cup, and it was hard to get everybody focused.
Do you regret the decisions you made that week, Kyle, or have you just kind of put it so far behind you now that you're good with whatever it was?
So that's the reason why the Ryder Cup captaincy is so hard, because everybody wants to second guess everything. So it's put behind me, and I'm done with it.
Well, Jackie Burke certainly helped you do that. One of the greats in this game. And Hal Sutton, one of the greats in this game. Hal, thanks for the time today.
Yep.
Always appreciate catching up with one of the plain-spoken guys in this game, Hal Sutton. Golf Today, I'll be right back. We're back on Golf Today. Golf Channel will have coverage of this week's Korn Ferry Tour event, the Club Car Championship. That begins Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time. This event, some notable past champions, including a now five-time winner on the PGA Tour, Sam Burns.
Now, Bryson Nimmer is one of the players you'll see in action this week. Nimmer is a winner on the Korn Ferry Tour. He broke through last year at the Tulum Championship, winning on the second hole of a sudden-death playoff. With the win, he secured fully exempt status for the remainder of the 2025 and 26 Korn Ferry Tour seasons. Take a look at Bryson's career notes here. Got that victory last year, the Tulum Championship, his first on the Korn Ferry Tour. He has 11 starts on the PGA Tour, and he was a two-time All-American at Clemson, as well as the 18-19 ACC Player of the Year. Let's welcome in Bryson Nimmer. Bryson, I want to talk to you about that victory last year on the Korn Ferry Tour in Tulum. How did that change your expectations for the rest of the season?
Yeah, it was awesome. It was amazing to get a win, and, you know, really kind of gave me the confidence the rest of the year to go out and compete. And it's really made life a lot easier, and hopefully I can get another one here soon.
The rest of the year brought some results for you, Bryson, that were a bit of a struggle. What did you work on over the off season to put yourself in the mindset for 2026?
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest thing for me was I kind of went into last year with not a lot of expectations. I had conditional status and a baby on the way, and just wasn't really able to get in shape for a full season. So, you know, I was very excited to get the win. That changed things a lot, and it gave me the opportunity this offseason to really put the work in that I wanted to have done last year. So, you know, looking forward to a good year this year. Had some decent results so far, and hopefully I can keep doing what I did that 1 week last year.
If we go back to last year again, I read that you were ready to walk away from the game if things didn't play out the way you wanted to that week. How did that free you up? And if you look back sort of in breaking it down, how has that helped you going forward in your career?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really puts things in perspective. You know, I didn't really know what I was going to be doing last year. The first 3 months of the year, really, I was not playing golf. I was out working at our family farm and, you know, kind of had to accept the fact that I may not get into any events. So, it's changed things a lot. A lot of gratitude just to be out here playing golf again, and I get to do what I love, and you know, I'm very grateful for that.
Preston, your wife is a local reporter down in South Carolina. She's covering this week's tournament. Is it safe to say that you're not actually going to turn down any media requests, or at least one media request this week?
No, I think I'll definitely be doing all the media requests this week. Absolutely hers for sure. She's going to be here all week, which is amazing. And I look forward to getting to see her every day.
I was reading on Instagram that you consider yourself a bit of a gadget guy. I think you did one thing on the putter grip that you use when you're practicing. How much flack do you catch when you're on a putting green or on a range with something like that on the Korn Ferry Tour?
You know, it's amazing. When I brought it out, I didn't really think anybody would notice. And almost every guy's got a one-liner for it. But hey, you know, whatever works, it makes me feel more confident. So I'm not going to stop doing it.
You put yourself in contention, Bryson. The very first tournament of the year in the Bahamas was a late triple bogey that kind of undid things. There was a penalty shot in there as well, kind of a strange turn of events. Did you leave a week like that feeling full of positives that that's how well you'd played in the first week of the year? Or did you walk away from that week thinking about what might have been?
A little bit of both. I was very excited. I mean, first event of the year to come out and, you know, with a little bit of firepower, that was awesome. Just kind of showed that everything I worked on in the off season was working. So I think more positive than negative. Obviously, you know, down the stretch, not being able to close it out, that always hurts. But I learned a lot from it, and just grateful that I was in the position. And hopefully next time I'll know what to do.
Much more consistent this year on the Korn Ferry Tour, really, than the way you finished up last year on the Korn Ferry Tour. Is that difference more mental or physical?
Yeah, I think a little bit of both. Physically, I definitely feel like I'm ready to compete every week, which, you know, is a great feeling. And I think that's bled over into just the confidence. I definitely don't have the weeks right now where I show up and, you know, not too sure how it's going to go. So definitely a lot more confidence and just excited for the rest of the year, really.
Well, Bryson, thank you so much for your time. Good luck this week and good luck with that reporter. I hear wives can ask the most difficult questions.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed talking to you.